Last week we covered a lot of ground. Three chapters, chapter 7 to 10. Of course, today we're in Exodus chapter 11 and 12. And in that, those three chapters, there was nine plagues that God brought against Egypt. And interestingly, the first three plagues also affected the Hebrews. It was not until the fourth one that God began to make a separation. And the other thing that I kind of wanted to point out about that, six of those nine were preceded by Aaron and Moses appearing before Pharaoh and saying, "The God of the Hebrews has said, let my people go." And of course, every time God hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let them go. And as it went along, he began to compromise a little, said, "Well, the men can go." And then, "Well, you can go, but just a little ways." And every time that he came up with a compromise, Moses said no. And I think that's an important lesson for us. If we're going to carry out God's plan, we can't compromise with what he has for us to do. We have to do his work his way. I want to start with the last two verses of chapter 10. "And Pharaoh said unto him, Get thee from me, take heed to thyself, see my face no more, for in that day thou seest my face, thou shalt die. And Moses said, Thou hast spoken well, I will see thy face again no more." Before, as I just said, plagues were preceded by Moses and Aaron being in front of Pharaoh. Now Pharaoh says, "Get out, don't come back." We need to notice that in these first three verses of chapter 11, they're basically parenthetic. It doesn't go directly from verse 29 chapter 10. So there's a little, if you're trying to read it through without understanding that those three verses are kind of a parentheses, then it doesn't really make sense, because the order of the speaking is interrupted by these first three verses. Okay, chapter 11, verse 1. "And the Lord said unto Moses, Yet will I bring one plague more upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards he shall let you go hence. When he shall let you go, he shall surely thrust thee out hence altogether. Speak now in the ears of the people, and let every man borrow of his neighbor, and every woman her neighbor, jewels of silver and jewels of gold." And the Lord gave, in verse 3, "And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, and in the sight of the people." I think a lot of times when we begin reading through the Bible, we look at everything as just a sequence of events that occur. Some of them are good, some of them are bad. It was a bad thing that Joseph's brothers hated him and sold him into slavery in Egypt. It was a good thing that Potiphar was the one that bought him out of the slave market. And of course, God was with Joseph, and everything that he touched turned to good. And so he wound up being the head of Potiphar's household. And then along comes Potiphar's wife and accuses him of attempted rape. And so he goes back to prison. Well, he's in prison, but yet he rises up to where he's basically over the prison. Pharaoh's baker and butler or cupbearer get thrown into prison. They have a dream, and Joseph is able to interpret that dream. And then ultimately, he interprets the dream of Pharaoh. And so he becomes second in the land of Egypt. And then, of course, there's 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. And during the famine, Joseph's family comes down and lives in Egypt, in the land of Goshen. And it's just, it seems like it's just a series of events. One thing happens after another. But if we go back to Genesis chapter 15, where God first made a covenant with Abraham, and in verse 5, he told him to look up at the heavens, and if he could count the stars, that was the number of his offspring, that they would be the stars of the heaven. And then in verse 13, he tells them, and he said unto Abram, know of a surety thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, that is, serve the people of that land, and they shall afflict them for 400 years. In verse 14, and also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterwards shall they come out with great substance. It wasn't just a sequence of events that happened. It was God's plan for his people. You know, if God hadn't given the Hebrews favor with the Egyptians, do you think they would have voluntarily given up their silver and their gold? It was only because that was part of God's plan. It wasn't an afterthought that, well, we're finally going to get out. Let's do something to do. It was his plan all along that they would do that. And Moses said, verse 4, now we're past the parenthetic part, and he's talking to Moses. Verse 4 would actually follow verse 29 of chapter 10. And Moses said, thus saith the Lord, about midnight will I go out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sitteth upon the throne, even unto the firstborn of the maidservant that is behind the mill, and all the firstborn of the beast. In verse 6, and there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there was none like it, shall be like it any more. Of course, the midnight, it was not going to be midnight of that day that Moses was actually talking to Pharaoh. It would be midnight of the day of destruction, which is going to come later. We don't know what that time interval was from the time that Moses was there talking to Pharaoh to the time that it would have been the day of destruction. But we know it had to be prior to the 10th day of the month because of what we read here in chapter 12. And of course, the firstborn referred to the first males. In the human sense, the male is the extension of the family, and particularly the firstborn, because normally they are the ones that's considered the head of the family when the father dies. And it goes down from firstborn to firstborn, from generation to generation. And of course, in the animals, males are the increase of the herd. And so they were firstborn of all of the animals. From Pharaoh, the very greatest in the land, down to the maidservant behind the mill. The grinding of the grain, it was two stones on top of each other, and you had to turn. You put the grain, the corn or whatever, in the middle, and as you grind, it would work out and finer until it came out from under the top stone. And it was considered the most menial of work because it was so hard, a very hard job. And so basically from only the lowest rank of people, either the low-ranking women or slaves, were the only ones that did the grinding. So it's an illustration there from the very greatest to the very least. The firstborn male of everyone is going to die. In verse 6, it says a great cry. Imagine in almost every house, there's somebody that's firstborn. And so almost every house in the land is going to experience this. And imagine the crying and the howling and the mourning that's going on when this happens. So it's going to be a great cry. Never was before, never will be again. In verse 7, but against any of the children of Israel shall not a dog move his tongue against man or beast, that ye may know how that the Lord doth put a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. This first part there is just a proverb of expressing freedom from alarm or from assault. We see a very similar construction over in Joshua chapter 10, verse 21, which says the dog will not bark. So God is going, he's already made a difference between Egypt and Israel in the fourth through the ninth plagues. Those did not affect the people in Goshen. They did not affect the Hebrews. But he's reiterating here, there's going to be a difference between. Verse, and all thy servants, that is Pharaoh's servants, shall come down unto me and bow down themselves unto me, saying, get thee out, and all the people that follow thee. And after that, I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in a great anger. Moses was supposedly one of the meekest men of all the earth. But he had gotten to a point where he was angry. We've been through 9 plagues, and God said there's going to be one more. And I think Moses was about fed up. He was ready to go. And so he went out in great anger, even though he was a very meek man. I think when I was making my notes, I skipped a couple of verses. Verses 9 and 10, and the Lord said unto Moses, shall not hearken unto you. Remember, from the very beginning, God has told Moses that I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart. He's not going to listen to you. But you got to go in there and tell him what I tell you to tell him anyway. Can you think of somebody else that God did that with? How about Jeremiah? He said, I want you to go preach to the people, but they're not going to listen to you. And so we've got a similar thing here. God is letting this stuff build up to the point, basically, that it's going to boil over. It's been bad, the bad, the bad, the worse, and now it's going to get really worse. And see, I'm not sure. Let me go back and begin verse 9 again. And the Lord said unto Moses, Pharaoh shall not hearken unto you, that my wonders may be multiplied in the land. There's a purpose for everything that God does. And he's wanting to make an example that nobody, that there's a difference between the Egyptians and the Hebrews. Verse 10, and Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh. And the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart so that he would not let the children of Israel go out of his land. I believe when we back first started, the idea was to send, Pharaoh wanted to get rid of the people of Israel because they were becoming big people. Then they realized, hey, here's some pretty cheap labor. Let's put them in servitude. And so they have been in servitude now and building the cities for Pharaoh and whatever. But now it's time that God says, it's time for my people to come out. And verse 12, chapter 12, verse 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. This was the month Abib, or also known as Nisan, and it was to be the beginning of the religious year. The civil year remained the same, but Abib corresponds basically to our March in April. This year, the Passover was March the 27th, so it's right in there. March and April is this month, and it was to be the beginning of months as far as the religious activities were concerned. It was the beginning of the nation of Israel. They were about to come out. When they went down there, it was a small group. Now 400 years later, it's a large group. It's now grown into enough people to be a nation. And it's the beginning of them as the people of Jehovah, where the whole group will be considered the children of God. It was the first month of Israel's new life as a redeemed people. They've been in servitude now for 400 years, and now they're being redeemed. In verse 3, speaking unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, in the 10th day of the month, they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for an house. The term that's used there for lamb is kind of a general term. When we see the word lamb, we think of young sheep. But it was more of a general term. It take a member of the flock. As we get on down in verse 5, we'll see that it could be a sheep or a goat that they were supposed to take. In verse 4, and if the household be too little for the lamb, the general consensus is if there was less than 10 people, that there should be at least 10 people for each lamb. If the household be too little for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next unto his house take it according to the number of the souls. Every man according to his eating shall make your count for the lamb. So if you only had 5 people in your household and your neighbor had 5 or 6, then you were to go together so that there would be enough people to eat all of the lamb, because we're going to see later that to all be eaten. In verse 5, your lamb shall be without spot or without blemish, a male of the first year. Ye shall take it out from the sheep or from the goats. In verse 6, and ye shall keep it up until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening. To take the lamb up and basically bring it into the house. It became a part of the family. And it was like a pet that they had taken out and had brought it in. They were to keep it there for 4 days. until the 14th. And part of that was to be sure that there was no that showed up after they had actually picked the lamb. So it was to be checked every day to make sure that it was still a perfect lamb without blemish. The lamb was a symbol of taking the place of the firstborn of that family. The lamb would be sacrificed in place of losing the firstborn. And then all of them were to be sacrificed at the same time on the same day, on the 14th day at even. There's a lot of discussion about what that at even means. First off, we would think that it would be that time between sundown and dark. Evening normally being considered when the first stars appear in the sky. Others say that it was intended to mean that in the lengthening of the shadows. As the shadows began to gray longer, then they were there. And later on, it became more of a custom that it would occur about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, about the time of evening sacrifice. The evening sacrifices were actually moved up, and then the Passover lambs would be killed after the sacrifice. Can you think of something else that happened about 3 o'clock in the afternoon? A very important event. Jesus on the cross at the ninth hour, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, is when he gave up the ghost and released himself to the Father. There's a little bit more of a parallel there between this and Jesus, and I had never realized this until I was studying the 70th week prophecy of Daniel. But actually, Jesus Christ entered into Jerusalem, his triumphal entry, when he rode in on the donkey, was on the 10th day of Abib. And 4 days later, he was crucified. I've always believed that Jesus is our Passover lamb. But I had never seen that parallel until I was studying this other stuff. Verse 7, and they shall take of the blood and strike it on the two side posts and on the upper door post of the houses wherein they eat it. Wherever they were going to have it, if it was just one family or if it was two families joined together, wherever that was lamb was to be eaten, they were to take that blood and put it on the two doorposts and on what we would refer to as the lintel. When you put it on the side post in the lintel, it's something that you're going to look at. You put it down on the threshold where it's going to be trampled on. it doesn't say it here, but if we go on down to verse 22, they were used hyssop to basically use as a paintbrush to brush it with. Kind of a bush plant and made a pretty good thing to use for a paintbrush to put the. Think about faith that was required to do this. What tangible evidence did they have that if they did this, if they sprinkled this blood, that their family would be spared? You had to do it in faith. The death angel came by and he saw on the doorposts. He didn't go in to see who was, what kind of character they were. All he looked for was the blood. And that's why it's so important that we have the blood of Christ applied to our lives. Because then everything else, once we've confessed our sins and God has forgiven us of our sins, then we're covered by the blood of Jesus. And we don't have to worry about what we've been in the past. Back in the plague 4 through 9, required. The Hebrews were protected just because God was making a separation. But here, on this 10th plague, they had to take action. If they didn't take the action, there'd be no blood. The death angel would not pass over that house. And we have to take action. Salvation is free, but we have to come to God and ask Him to forgive us of our sins. We have to take action in order to receive the blessing of salvation. In verse 8, and they shall eat the flesh in that night, roast with fire and unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs shall they eat it. Roasting would have been a little bit quicker. As we go into the next verse, we'll say that it's not to, see that it's not to be boiled. But roasting is a little quicker than putting some meat on to boil. So it was to be done. There's a symbol of urgency throughout this. They were to eat unleavened bread. There was no time to put the leaven in the bread and let it rise. So they were to eat it just unleavened bread. And then the bitter herbs to remind them of the harsh treatment that they had in Egypt. And later we'll see that this was to be a memorial that was carried on from 1 year to the next, and they're still doing it today. Bitter herbs were to remind them, and it suggested that maybe it was wild lettuce, endive, chicory, peppermint, or even dandelion, that it would be a bitter herb. It was not sweet. In verse 9, eat not of it raw, that basically not half cooked. It was to be completely cooked. Nor sodden at all with water. It wasn't to be boiled. That would take time. But roast with fire, his head with his legs, and with the pertinence thereof. You're actually supposed to cook this thing with the innards in the body. They were taken out, cleansed, put back in the body, and then the whole thing was roasted. basically using the whole lamb was a symbol of the unity of Israel. There wasn't part of it taken out and thrown away, but it was all in there. Did they eat of that part? I don't know. They may have, may not. But anyway, it was to be cooked as the entire animal. Verse 10, and ye shall let nothing of it remain until the morning, and that which remaineth of it until the morning shall ye shall burn with fire. There's not to be any of it left that might become profaned, that it might spoil. If it was not eaten, it was to be burned, to get rid of it completely. And again, in verse 11, and thus shall you eat it, with your loins girded, that is, take the long flowing outer garment, tuck it up into the sash that they used, what they called a girdle, so that the legs were exposed, ready for work or ready to move freely. Your shoes on your feet. Normally, if they were in the house eating, they would have their shoes off. And your staff in your hand. And ye shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. I remember Brother Derek was either teaching a lesson or preaching on this, and he made the comment that they were lounging around the table to eat. I shook my head or something, because somewhere I had heard or read that they were to eat it standing up, you know, ready to go. Well, I did some searching, and it doesn't say that. But it does say that they were to eat it with their shoes on and their staff in their hand. If they were down, it would be kind of uncomfortable, I think, to have the staff in their hand. But if I heard or read it, that they were up, it's not in the Bible. But anyway. Verse 12. For I will pass through the land of Egypt this night, and will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt will I execute judgment. I am the Lord. To say that he was going to pass through Egypt would be in judgment. And I think that somewhere back in the very beginning, the writer of the study guide made a comment that all of these plagues were related to one of the gods of Egypt. And so God says here that he's going to pass judgment against all these gods. So each plague represents one of the gods of Egypt. They had many. They had at least 40 gods. And each one of these plagues related directly to one of them. In verse 13, and the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where ye are. When I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. To pass over in mercy. Again, when they saw the blood, when the death angel saw the blood on that house, that was a sign to pass over that house and not take the firstborn of that family. Any questions or comments? Okay, let's take a break.